Peter Holzapple, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show on Monday, January 31st. And we have all sorts of songs and sounds and stories for you today, including WGXC's Jack Sensabaugh. We'll speak with Cindy LaPierre from the Mountaintop Historical Society about some mountain history in Greene County. In this month's edition of Backtracks in Time, we'll also hear the WGXC Congressional Report this hour, including news about representatives of the 19th and 20th Congressional Districts and the candidates running against them. Plus, we'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather, the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And it all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Connection and the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network.
This is the news.
This
is the network.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Blanche Mackey Photography of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
This is Tom Rowe with the WGXC local news for Monday, January 31st. From the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org. Noah Eckstein is reporting for Columbia Green Media that the Hudson Common Council at a special meeting January 27th unanimously approved a tourism board grant of $16,500 to support a monthly gallery crawl in the city. Ellen Darcy Simpson, Susan Ellie, and Jeremy Bullis, all Hudson gallery owners, came up with the idea to have local businesses extend their hours on the second Saturday of each month as a way to stimulate the local economy. Some of the money will go towards minimizing the need for self-transportation for tourists who wish to stay in Hudson and ski at Windham Mountain. For the weekend of February 12th, the Wick Hotel in Hudson is offering a discounted stay rate to anyone interested in booking an integrated ski and stay package. The Common Council authorized Mayor Kamal Johnson to enter into a contract with Johnston Transportation to provide two school buses for tourists to visit Windham Mountain. It's hoped this initiative will drive added foot traffic to the second Saturday gallery crawl and to restaurants and shops throughout the city. Quote, "I don't see any downside to this," unquote, said 4th Ward Alderperson Theo Anthony. 1st Ward Alderperson Art Frick agreed the venture is important for the city, but he also said more could be done. Quote, "Moving forward with plans like this, I would love to see us explore things that are more economically viable to a greater number of people," unquote, Frick said. Simpson noted that there are 25 art galleries in Hudson, giving the city the largest concentration of galleries on a single street in the Hudson Valley. Quote, we're pivoting and figuring things out as we go, unquote, she said. Note, Johnson is a WGXC volunteer on-air programmer. Read more about the story at HudsonValley360.com. Nick Reisman is reporting for New York State of Politics that the Farm Labor's Wage Board at the State Department of Labor January 28th backed a proposal to lower the overtime threshold for agricultural businesses from 60 hours to 40 hours a week. The decision in favor of a phased-in overtime plan was praised by labor advocates, but sharply opposed by organizations that represent farmers. Lowering the overtime threshold could benefit the workers on farms with higher pay. But the New York Farm Bureau and other agricultural-aligned business groups argue the move would hurt smaller producers, lead to higher food prices and out-of-state products, while also reducing the number of people they can employ. Quote, changing the overtime threshold to 40 hours a week for farm workers in New York means that these workers will be limited to 40 hours due to simple farm economics, unquote, said Grow New York Farms, a coalition of organizations opposed to the change. Quote, this is not a win for farm workers that self-proclaimed worker advocates will claim, unquote. The change will not take effect until 2024 and would be phased in over 8 years. Previously, farm workers have been paid differently than grocery store workers, who are allowed to take overtime pay after 40 hours, where farm workers have not. This will even the playing field. Some officials, including Governor Kathy Hochul, are discussing ways of offsetting the cost of the overtime move through tax credits. Read more about the story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. The world is in its third year of a deadly virus that has taxed healthcare workers like no others. At the same time, some members of Congress, including Paul Tonko locally, have signed on to a letter to get the federal government to cap nurses' pay. HealthAffairs.org reports that, quote, an unprecedented number of nurses are retiring early and exiting the workforce or quitting their hospital employment to return as employees of staffing agencies, unquote. Tonko and the other representatives see rising wages for nurses as a problem. Quote, we are writing because of our concerns that certain nurse staffing agencies are taking advantage of these difficult circumstances to increase their profits at the expense of patients and the hospitals that treat them, unquote, the letter to White House COVID-19 response team coordinator Jeffrey Zients says. The almost 200 congressional representatives signing on to the letter are a mixed lot, with far-right figures such as Elise Stefanik, conservative Republican Liz Cheney, centrist Democrat Tonko, and liberal Ilhan Omar all in favor. Nurses, however, mostly do not want their salaries capped. There's evidence that nursing wages are up, like in many other fields with high demand for workers. The American Healthcare Association last year sent a letter to the Federal Trade Commission urging the FTC to protect consumers from anti-competitive and unfair practices regarding agency staffing. And the Berkshire Eagle is reporting that Winterfest is coming back to the city of North Adams, Massachusetts, after a pandemic-induced hiatus in 2021. The downtown festival with ice skating, wagon rides, and ice sculpture will take place on February 19th. The event will include a farmer's market, a craft fair, a campfire, ice sculpture carving, and weather permitting, playing in the snow at Colgrove Park, said Susie Elmy, the event's coordinator. Plus, horse-drawn wagon rides up and down Main Street, and the city's skating rink will offer free admission and rentals. Because of the continuing pandemic, there will not be the usual chowder cook-off. Quote, unfortunately, that's one of the more popular events, unquote, Helmy said. Quote, we will have to have fun without it this year, unquote. More information will be available on the North Adams Tourism Facebook page, Helmy said. Read more about this story in the Berkshire Eagle. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
Hello, radio listeners of the universe. This is DJ Patty Boom, the host of Vinyl Freedom, right here on 90.7 WGXC every first and third Tuesday of the month from 12:10 to 2 p.m. So this Tuesday, February 3rd, is my one-year anniversary of the Vinyl Freedom Show, where I spend the afternoon with you spinning all kinds of magical wax. So come have the bubbly with me and tune in to Vinyl Freedom. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, January 31st. We are 6.8% of the way through the year, 48 days left until spring, everybody. Early morning temperatures are negative 1 in Hubble Corners and 2 degrees in Lamontville. As for snow, there are reports of 1 inch in Red Hook, 2.5 in Glenmont, and 1.3 inches in Ancrumdale. Today is going to be mostly sunny with a high of 28 degrees at 2 p.m. Conditions will be freezing, so layer up if heading out. Overnight temperatures fall to 8 degrees before bouncing back up to 35 degrees tomorrow afternoon, which will be cloudier than tomorrow morning. 25 degrees overnight takes us into a dry but cloudy Wednesday. A high of 42 is expected. A little dip to 35 degrees keeps things liquid as precipitation starts to fall overnight. Rain on Thursday with a high of 41 degrees. Friday, we spin the wheel, Raggedy Man, as temperatures fall in different places at different rates. Different people will see different things. Stay tuned as the crystal ball comes into focus. Sunset today will be at 4:53 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:05 a.m. Looking way up, we see a 40% chance of M-class solar flares today with a 10% chance of X-class flares. Radio blackouts and GPS interference could occur today. A CME is heading right for us, due to hit on Wednesday. Solar wind speed is currently 514 kilometers per second at 10 of protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 70, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Jane Scarpolino of New Haven, Connecticut. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeples. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
Thank you. Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And Joe Biden's weakness and incompetence is creating a very real risk of World War III. Look at what's going on. This would have never happened with us.
At a campaign-style rally in Texas on Saturday, former President Donald Trump bashed President Joe Biden's handling of North Korea and the Afghanistan withdrawal. The former president said he might run again and said if given the chance, he would pardon people charged with criminal offenses after the January 6th Capitol attack. Trump ally South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham called the pardon proposal inappropriate. Graham told CBS he didn't want to send the signal that it is okay to defile the Capitol. Republican Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, the current National Governors Association chair, said Trump should not lead the party or the country again. After touring the site of a bridge collapse in Pittsburgh over the weekend, President Biden stressed the need for nationwide infrastructure improvements and touted his Build Back Better plan.
Across the country, there are 45,000 bridges in poor condition. It's just simply unacceptable.
In COVID-19 news, cases are declining in many parts of the country. On Sunday, White House top medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said things were, quote, looking good and going in the right direction. Spotify says it will add a content advisory to guard against COVID-19 misinformation. Joe Rogan's podcast there has provoked backlash for false vaccine claims. The United Nations Security Council will press Russia on its threatening Ukraine, according to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. An Army Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley urged Russia to stand down and choose diplomacy.
Armed force should always be the last resort. Success here is through dialogue.
Ireland has marked 50 years since Bloody Sunday, when British soldiers killed 13 while firing on a crowd of largely Catholic protesters. Thousands marked the anniversary of one of the turning points of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Just days after the banning of Mouse by a Tennessee school district, two editions of Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the Holocaust have reached the top 20 on Amazon. The McMinn County School Board voted to remove Mouse due to inappropriate language and an illustration of a nude woman, according to minutes from a board meeting. Finally, thousands of customers were without power in Massachusetts after a historic blizzard dumped as much as 2 feet of snow on Saturday. Boston tied its record for the most snow to fall in one day, with the city's sixth largest snowstorm of all time. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Tom Rowe with WGXC in ACRO with this week's WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 19th and 20th congressional seats in New York. Current Democratic Representatives Antonio Delgado and Paul Tonko vote with the positions of President Joe Biden 100% of the time, according to the 538.com website.
William J. Kimball is reporting for the Daily Freeman. In remarks delivered on January 26, U.S. Representative Antonio Delgado told attendees at the Ulster County Regional Chamber of Commerce breakfast that the current division between the Democrats and Republicans will not get in the way of working to resolve detrimental bureaucracy. At that meeting, Ellenville Regional Hospital President Stephen Kelly noted that the Rhinebeck Democrat was able to work with Republican U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik of Charlottesville to address problems caused by a regulation change that occurred without public input. He said, and I quote, "It was not in the Federal Register that could lead to the closure of half of the small hospitals in New York," end quote. Kelly said Delgado and Stefanik have continued an 18-month push with recent efforts to have the Congress adopt the Protecting Rural Access to Care Act and making a direct appeal to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Delgado said, and I quote, "Elise Stefanik, obviously we're not in the same party. There are different politics, but we care about an issue that speaks directly to our community. We both have critical access to hospitals that we know our communities depend upon, and that's where the work needs to be done," end quote. Other facilities impacted include Margaretville Hospital and O'Connor in Delhi. The proposed legislation restores the rural hospital criteria for determining a critical access designation. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Democrats controlling New York's legislature plan to vote on new redistricting maps this coming week. New York's Redistricting Commission of Democrats, New York's Redistricting Commission of Democrats and Republicans failed to reach a bipartisan agreement on district boundaries for the state Senate, Assembly, and U.S. House of Representatives. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hestie released a statement together on January 26, and I quote, "The statutory deadline for the Independent Redistricting Commission to submit congressional and state legislative maps has passed. As per the New York State Constitution, it becomes the legislature's responsibility to consider fair maps and ensure all New Yorkers have equitable representation in their government. That is a duty we take seriously. Given the expedited nature of the political calendar, we fully expect the Senate and the Assembly to consider new fair maps in a timely manner. The plan is to vote on these maps next week," end quote. Democrats are deciding because they hold the majority in the state legislature. The Election Commission was set up so legislators would not be drawing their own district lines, but obviously failed to do that. Locally, candidates such as Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro have already announced an effort to unseat Representative Antonio Delgado, but neither of them know what district exactly they are running to represent until the lines are drawn. You can read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Nick Reisman reports for Spectrum News that Zephyr Teachout, who lost a bid for Congress in the 19th Congressional District in 2016, is now joining New York Attorney General Letitia James's office as a special advisor and senior counsel for economic justice. The activist and Fordham Law School professor last year announced she was running for Attorney General after James announced her run for governor, but after James decided instead to run for re-election, Teachout ended her campaign. She praised James in making the announcement of her new job in the Attorney General's office. Teachout wrote, and I quote, "She pushed for reforms to modernize New York State's own antitrust laws and give enforcers the tools they need to hold dominant firms accountable. I couldn't be happier to be working with her and the extraordinary lawyers and leaders in her office," end quote. Teachout ran for Attorney General in 2018 but lost to James. She previously lost elections for governor in 2014 and against Republican John Faso in the 19th congressional election in 2016. And you can read more about that story at Spectrum News.
Find out where the music takes Asteroid Anxiety on the next Deep Threes, when the producer discovers the tranquility of a dwarf planet. Plus sounds from Umber, Matoma, Yuja Wang, and Ramin Djawadi. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, we hear from Jack Sensabaugh on his monthly Backtracks in Time segment about local history. This month, he's speaking with Cindy LaPierre of the Mountaintop Historical Society. This is just an excerpt of the interview. You can hear the entire discussion in the WGXC audio archives at wgxc.org.
Hello, and welcome to Backtracks. Tracks in Time. I'm Jack Sensabaugh, and my guest for this edition is Cindy LaPierre, a board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society. And today on this edition, we're going to be talking about the upcoming 200th anniversary of the Catskill Mountain House. So welcome, Cindy.
Thank you, Jack.
Cindy's been a couple of times before, so it's nice to see you again. So when she first told me it was the 200th anniversary, it threw me for a minute. Then I realized there was a smaller building up there at first, and 1823, before the famous hotel that we're all familiar with. So, listening now, I think the good way to start is talking about just the natural beauty of that area up there on Pine Orchard. Yep. So,
thank you, Jack, because the natural beauty is what drew people to that area. And Charles Beach's father, Erastus Beach, owned a livery service in Catskill and sort of had the monopoly over transportation in Catskill and up on into the mountains. And he regularly took parties of people up to the Pine Orchard, which was the name of that spot that later became the Catskill Mountain House site.
Right.
And it was in doing that that he sort of got the idea that it would be good to have something there for travelers to rest, mm-hmm. take refreshment, or even stay overnight. Okay, so before I get into how that developed, mm-hmm. let me just read a little description by Washington Irving that comes at the very beginning of The Legend of Rip Van Winkle.
Okay.
Okay. Whoever, is this going to work? Whoever, I'm going to do it this way. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
You can edit, right?
Yeah, well, it's all right.
Whoever has made the voyage up the Hudson must remember the Catskill Mountains. They are a dismembered branch of the great Appalachian family and are seen away to the west of the river, swelling up to a noble height and lording it over the surrounding country. Every change of season, every change of weather, indeed every hour of the day, produces some change in the magic hues and shapes of these mountains, and they are regarded by all the good wives far and near as perfect barometers. When the weather is fair and settled, they are clothed in blue and purple and print their bold outlines on the clear evening sky. But sometimes, when the rest of the landscape is cloudless, they will gather a hood of gray vapors about their summits, which in the last rays of the setting sun will glow and light up like a crown of glory.
That's beautiful.
Okay. Yeah, that's
that is a
and
perfect description.
And one of the interesting things about Washington Irving and writing about the Catskills is that at the time that he wrote Rip Van Winkle, he had never actually come into the Catskills. But his vivid imagination as he sailed by down on the Hudson River brought him in. And interestingly, the Legend of Rip Van Winkle still is seen everywhere in the Catskills. Okay?
I come across this bridge every day.
Exactly. Okay, now, in order to prepare for today, I did some going back through especially the seminal book on the Catskill Mountain House, which is called The Catskill Mountain House, was written by Roland Van Zandt, who came into the area in the late 50s, early 60s. He had a home in Shandaken and saw the remnants of the Catskill Mountain House up there on the Pine Orchard, and he was absolutely fascinated. And so he started looking at some of the questions that we'll talk about some answers for today, like how did it come to be built, mm-hmm. who built it, how people got to it over the years, what they ate and drank when they were up there, what they thought and wrote about it, how it fell apart and ended up owned and burned down by the New York State DEC at 6 a.m. on the 25th of January in 1963.
Wow.
Okay, he spent years doing detailed research. He hiked the area, taking photos and interviewing people, combing archives, talking to local historians, tracking down prints, postcards, drawings, floor plans, going into the property records, immersing himself in the history and culture that surrounded the Catskill Mountain House for its 140 years in that spot on Pine Orchard.
Wow. He did his homework, that's for sure.
He did his homework. Okay, and how it came from humble beginnings to be one of the greatest hotels of the country. So the idea of having a place for visitors to stay overnight was inspired by day trips to the Pine Orchard by the Erastus Beach mm-hmm. with his livery. Okay, he, in fact, was not one of the owners of the early Catskill Mountain House, but he helped organize a company called the Catskill Mountain Association. Okay, even though he was not formally a member of that group. Mabel Parker Smith and Roland Van Zandt came to the conclusion that he didn't want to get into that part of the business. He was going to stick with the livery, which certainly kept him going well. Okay, so that Catskill Mountain Association mm-hmm. in 1823 built a shanty. Okay, it had bunks and straw for bedding. It was managed by Wilhelmus van Bergen, who leased and managed the first permanent building, okay, that was open, and then beyond that shanty, the first permanent building that opened in 1824. Okay, so the Beach family got into the Catskill Mountain House main building when Charles L. Beach mm-hmm. leased the building and started making the improvements that changed it from a federal style building to, you know, the beautiful
Corinthian
the beautiful palace with the Corinthian columns.
Right.
Okay. Everyone who lived below the mountain in Catskill and all along the Hudson River would look up,
yeah,
and that would be their sort of lodestone up there on the side of the mountain, on the Pine Orchard.
Pine Orchard. Well, I found out where Charles Beach lived in Catskill, right at the top of Bridge Street across from St. Patrick's Church. And he said from his bedroom up in the upper part of the house, because he could look straight over at the mountains and see the mountain house.
So he knew it was still there every morning. Every
right.
morning. Okay, yeah. Yes, he could. And he built a equally beautiful house and home for his family down there in that spot in Catskill.
Yes.
Okay. He said that his first visit to the Pine Orchard was at age 15 when he drove one of his father's coaches to the grand opening of that shanty on July 4th, 1823. And the mountain house was the first of its kind in the country and considered one of the best. One of the best.
That's a pretty good reputation.
A pretty good reputation.
Yes.
It became part of the wealthier people from New York City and the East Coast when they did the grand tour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the stops was always the Catskill Mountain House. Okay, assuming they were willing to put up with what it took to get there.
Yes. Now I was going to say whether most of these visitors came from pretty much the city, or
the city, the East Coast.
Okay.
I mean, the city, New York City, at that time. And through the whole 140 years that the Catskill Mountain House was there, mm-hmm. okay, there was a larger population in New York City than in all of the large southern cities combined. Okay, so Philadelphia, Boston, New York City, but mainly New York City. They were all coming up. And it was not an easy thing to do.
No.
Okay. And when it first opened, it was open right around the same time the Erie Canal opened, and around the same time Robert Fulton
mm-hmm.
made a success of the steamboat. So the main way to get to the Catskill Mountain House from New York City was coming up the Hudson River on a steamboat. Right. And getting off in Catskill, okay, at the place where you can still go to.
Right, there. Catskill is that, Point.
Is that little museum still open?
Well, Dick Brooks, retired in 2016, and it stayed closed for a few years. This last summer, I was down there for some event, and I saw somebody sitting in there at the desk. So I don't know. I wish I had the time. I would have done that in a heartbeat because I love talking to the people in there. But
yes,
yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
I do this, so it kind of works out nicely.
Works out nicely, Jack. Yeah. Thank you. But yes, for a long time, Dick Brooks, who also wrote a column for the Wyndham Journal, still writes a column for the Mountain Eagle.
That's great. Okay. Whittling away.
And who also taught history in Greenville for years, would be there at the
historic Catskill Point. Well,
Riverkeepers
Freightmasters Museum.
Freightmasters Museum at historic Catskill Point. You can still go to historic Catskill Point.
Yes.
And watch the ships come up and down the river.
I've been there frequently in the summertime, sitting there and just watching. Yeah.
And the steamboats. Isn't like another whole side topic.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Because the steamboats on the Hudson, well, they took over from the sloops. Originally, they were Hudson River sloops, but those were not really great for passenger travel. So the steamships, people knew the names of the steamships. There was the Great Mary Powell, and there was the Cotterskill, and there was
Antiora.
Antiora. There were so many of them.
Peter Stuyvesant, I think, was another one.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And they reached lengths of I have this number somewhere. 2,000 feet.
Wow.
No, maybe not that. Wait a minute. No. That would be ridiculous. Okay.
Yeah.
They were 400 feet long.
Okay.
But they could carry up to 5,000 passengers.
Right. I think somebody said more than, I think it was Dick that told me at one time, it's more than the Titanic.
There were, a lot of people. And they were coming from New York City to Catskill. They would get off the steamboat in Catskill and then get on a stagecoach. Well, now we'll talk about that in just a minute. But let me just go back to the steamships. The steamships would sometimes the captains would get into these little competitions with each other and race up the Hudson River. And there are stories of them running out of fuel as the steamships were coming up the river and starting to break up the furniture.
Oh, gosh.
You know, to keep it going. Anyway, I think I'm happy not to be going up on the steamboats under those conditions.
Yeah, I'm sure the passengers love this.
Okay. So when they would get to Catskill, Mr. Beach, Erastus Beach, and his family would greet them, and have stagecoaches ready for them to go on. Now, there's a broadsheet from the Catskill Mountain House that says Mountain House Passenger Depot at Catskill Landing, agent and assistants in attendance on the arrival of the Hudson, this was the railroad trains and the day boats. The stage fare was $2 from Catskill to the Catskill Mountain House. At Pine Orchard. Okay. Oh, and it's Charles A. Beach's Mountain House Stages and Carriages.
Okay.
So it's no longer Erastus.
Right. By that
okay,
because
this broadsheet is from 1880.
Okay. Yeah,
okay.
Just
so
before the railroad.
The Hudson River Railroads were probably just starting right after the Civil War.
Right.
We got the railroads coming up. But the stagecoach ride.
I'm sure it was just a nice, comfortable ride
up
the mountain,
ride.
Right?
Well, it was 12 miles from Catskill Point to the top of the mountain at the Catskill Mountain House. Okay, and the first 8 miles, 7 miles, was pretty flat. Okay, mm-hmm. You can, if you drive along Route 23A.
Yep.
Okay, from Catskill toward the mountain road.
Right.
Okay, it's pretty flat, no problems, mm-hmm. Everything's going great. And then you go through the toll gate and onto this rocky road with all kinds of S-turns in it and very narrow. And if you're from the city...
Mm-hmm. I'd be getting a little frightened at this point.
I think you might be getting a little frightened at this point. And there was even a point at which... most of the passengers would be asked to disembark from the stagecoaches because mm-hmm. It was too much for the horses.
Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, some of the passengers would choose to walk alongside the livery coach, okay? Others would be asked to walk alongside mm-hmm. the livery coach. And it was a noisy... rough. I mean, when you were in it, it was a noisy and rough ride.
Yeah.
So at some point, they were just grateful, I think, to get out. And walk. Okay. Even though it was fairly steep, mm-hmm. but after, you know, they were coming up for the scenery and walking up steep paths was part of the scenery.
Starting already. I think after a journey like that, I need a few days just to recover from that once I got there.
Well, it's funny because. Among the people that wrote about their experiences, mm-hmm. some of them were horrified, and it was awful, and it took a while to get their composure back when they got to the top. But actually, most of them, when they got to the top, mm-hmm. you know, they breathed that sigh of relief, yeah. but then they looked around and they went, oh, wow.
Gorgeous.
This was worth it. Mm-hmm. This was definitely worth it. Okay, so I don't, you know, there are letters on both sides of that one, but most of the people or many of the people who came to the mountain house kept journals. Okay, so there are writings mm-hmm. of how people reacted to that whole adventure. Okay,
right. I don't know if it was in Van Zandt's book or somewhere, but even the horses, their flanks would be steaming by the time they got. Done.
Exactly. And that's even when people had gotten out of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, their flanks were steaming. I think it was in his book. Wow. As well as in other places. Okay.
Okay. Well, we've come to the end of part one of this edition of Backtracks in Time. Again, my guest is Cindy LaPierre, board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society. And we're talking about the Catskill Mountain House. And we will continue in segment two. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're joined today by Karen Beadle, who is co-coordinator of Capital District Border Watch, and they are doing some work around the New York for All Act, dealing with some immigration issues and how people are treated. But maybe we should first start, Karen. Can you give us a little bit of the background as to what Capital District Border Watch is?
Yeah, Capital District Border Watch came together in February of 2019. We were very involved with the ACLU and other local groups, Ice Free Capital District, and concerned about the situation at the border, especially as families were being separated in May of 2018. So we decided to consolidate the organizing and really be a place where people could continue to talk about the impact of the border, immigration policy in this country, needs of local immigrants, and to just keep the issues of immigration and the border alive here in the Capital Region.
Now, are there other groups also working on immigration issues in the Capital District that you guys sort of link up with?
Yeah, we link up with a variety of statewide organizations and initiatives. We work particularly closely with Ice Free Capital District and the Troy Sanctuary campaign. When we started, they were fairly involved in the resolution, sanctuary resolution in the city of Troy, and they've been doing the organizing at the Rensselaer County Jail around the contract between the jail and ICE. So we've done more work in organizing demonstrations and being focused on immigration at the southwest border, and they have been very involved in looking very specifically at those issues. They also have a care committee that looks at local immigrants' needs. So they fundraise for that committee, and we help them with that. They're currently supporting about 13 local undocumented families. And we also fundraise for Team Brownsville, which is at the U.S.-Mexican border between Brownsville and Matamoros.
Now, a lot of people in the Capital District, you know, became quite concerned during the Trump administration, you know, with the effort of ICE on many levels, but particularly trying to separate, you know, children from their parents when they were crossing the border, particularly both to seek asylum and as refugees. Has the situation significantly improved or changed under, you know, the Biden administration in terms of immigrant treatment?
No, not significantly. And I think it's one of the points of the Biden administration where they need to be pushed most seriously right now. The two biggest issues at the border are Title 42 and the Migrant Protective Protocols or Remain in Mexico policy. And both of those policies are in effect right now, which is basically shut down asylum at the border. So the biggest worrisome thing is the U.S. responsibility under international law to care and treat refugees with respect and to create protective haven for people fleeing harm. And that is significantly, it's pretty much come to a halt at the border. And that happened under Trump, but it's been carried through with Biden. And we're also seeing that in the European nations' response to the migrants from Northern Africa. So the dissolution of asylum is a huge issue all around the world right now.
I did read actually in the Troy Record, surprisingly, that I guess Canada has sort of adopted a different policy on treatment of people seeking asylum. And so once again, you get people taking the buses out to Plattsburgh, walking you know, across the border, getting arrested, but then being released as they deal with asylum. But that's not what the United States is doing, at least on the Mexican border.
No, but the other thing that's really interesting on the Canadian immigration front, yes, that Roxbury Road and other non-official border points, people are able to cross now. That was suspended for a number of months during COVID, but it is open again now. So yes, that's a trickle that's in. But the big Canadian immigration issue is that Canada considers the United States a safe third country, and they are reevaluating that. So if they decide that the U.S. is not a safe third country, people, immigrants will be allowed to, and asylum seekers will be allowed to pass through the United States and apply directly in Canada. And they can't do that now if they've already applied in the U.S.
Now, I received an email recently from Capital District Board of Watch that trying to get legislators to support the New York for All Act, which deals with how various police and other government agencies deal with individuals and their immigration status. Can you explain, you know, what is that bill doing and how is it looking at this point in the legislature?
Yeah, the goal really is to get it on the legislative calendar. So there's a push right now so that it will come out of committee and actually go for a vote this year, which it didn't last year. And it curbs a number of abuses, including stopping communities from being able to enter into the 287G agreements, which Rensselaer County entered into, agreeing to be an extension of ICE. So it will stop that from happening. And it will also address a number of abuses of ICE in terms of ICE's reach into the community, community agencies, the courts, healthcare. So immigrants in New York State often live in fear when they need healthcare or any kind of services because ICE can be involved in gathering that data. So the primary goal is to reduce fear in the undocumented population and to really incorporate everybody in New York State under the care of New York State. And the green light law, which allowed driver's licenses, was one of the big important ways that that has gotten moved forward in the last couple of years. And now we want to move it forward in terms of ICE not having access in the way they've had access to terrorize people.
Now, as a general rule of thumb, you know, in the New York State Legislature, at least, you know, Democrats tend to be a little bit more liberal. The Republicans tend to be more